Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. The U.S. election is just a few short weeks away, and many investors are picking through campaign trail noise to decipher what policies each administration would pursue and their implications. With both former President Trump and Vice President Harris promising hefty amounts of tax cuts, but few clues on how it will be funded, the longer-term trajectory for taxes, the deficit, and the federal debt is largely uncertain but likely to worsen and must be addressed. Today, I'm excited to be back with Dr. David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management, to discuss the different paths forward for fiscal policy. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can watch along on YouTube by tuning in to our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked in the show notes. Now, let's get started. David, welcome back to Insights Now.
Glad to be here.
So very hot topic, all things taxes, the deficit and the debt. What do you think are some of the most consequential fiscal policy proposals out there at the moment on the campaign trail?
Well, I think so. Let's deal with each campaign separately. Former President Trump has, in terms of dollars, promised more. So the first big thing is a full extension of all the tax cuts, the 2017 tax cuts, in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. So that means all the individual income tax cuts that were going to expire, plus things like the estate tax, continuing with a big exemption there. The corporate income tax rate, which was cut in that tax plan, would be extended just by doing that. But in addition to that, there are two other sort of buckets, I'd say. One of them is that he has promised to cut the corporate income tax rate from 21% down to 15%. And then second, after that, there's a group of things he's proposed to do. He wants to eliminate income tax on tips, eliminate income taxes on overtime, eliminate income taxes on Social Security, and also allow people to deduct the cost of interest on auto loans from their taxes. So there's a lot there in terms of overall tax cuts. Vice President Harris's campaign does have some tax cuts and stimulus. It would certainly extend most of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017 for households earning less than $400,000. But there are some actual tax increases in what she's proposing also, such as imposing a 5% tax on overall investment income. That's sort of called the Medicare tax. It's 3.8% right now. That would go to 5%. And then some taxes on very wealthy individuals, as well as a conversation, if she can get it through Congress, of increasing the corporate income tax rate. I think both candidates want to do an enhanced child tax credit, so you'd get there'll be some more fiscal spending there. And then Vice President Harris has also proposed a $25,000 grant for people who are first-time home buyers. So there's a lot of spending on both sides, but former President Trump is definitely spending more in tax cuts and spending than Vice President Harris would.
And it's interesting. We have to remember that the 2017 tax cuts, the individual ones, as you mentioned, David, they do sunset at the end of next year, yep. And they're worth about $4 trillion. So kind of, if we extend all of them, then the deficit worsens by that, and then additional tax cuts on top of that, and if there are any pay-fors or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem, because we had a structural budget deficit anyway before 2017. The 2017 tax cuts worsened that structural deficit, but before that was very apparent to everybody. Of course, it got hit by the pandemic recession and then everything that came along with that. But we now have a significant structural deficit, over 6% of GDP in the latest fiscal year, we believe, as a deficit. So that's an enormous deficit. And that deficit would be sustained if you just extend all those tax cuts. If you add on to it, the deficit climbs from 6% of GDP up to higher numbers, possibly 9 or 10% of GDP by 2034.
And that's assuming a soft landing, everything goes according to plan.
Absolutely. That's assuming just average economic growth. It's also assuming that you can fund all of this with 10-year Treasury rates between 3.5% and 4% is what's in the CBO's numbers. And therefore, the global investment public is willing to lend money to the government, the U.S. federal government, given that level of deficit and growth in debt.
And what happens then in these different scenarios to the debt pile. So currently we get a lot of questions about how high debt to GDP already is at 98% for fiscal year 2024, highest since World War II. Where are we headed from
here? Yeah, and just after World War II, we hit 106% of GDP, which was enormous. But of course, it was after funding World War II.
Yeah.
And then it came down very rapidly thereafter because the government did balance its books, but also the economy grew at a breakneck speed coming out of World War II. Now we've got an economy that's at full employment. It's growing at 2%, a little bit above 2% in real terms, another 2% inflation. But it's growing at a very moderate pace. But the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget actually analyzed both the Trump proposals and the Harris proposals. And the baseline for the CBO is if you allow all those tax cuts to expire, you go from 98% of GDP today up to 122% of GDP by 2034. Under the Harris plan, you'd go up to about 133% of GDP. And then under the Trump plan, you'd go up to about 143% of GDP. So really a massive increase in the trajectory of debt, but particularly under the Trump proposals.
Wow. And we often get asked, when is this all of this spending going to come to roost? When are we actually going to need to make some tough decisions? Or are we already kind of paying for it in some ways?
Well, we certainly haven't had a crisis in terms of funding, and we may not have one for some time to come. I think part of it is the actual amount of money the government wants to borrow. And then the other part is, well, how is the government functioning? And do global investors broadly trust the American government to always pay its bills? Mm-hmm. And so when you have things like a debt ceiling fight, those things can cause problems. But we really don't know. We're in uncharted territory. I must say I've been an optimist over the years because there is tremendous global demand for U.S. treasuries. So, you know, in the course of 2023, the federal government borrowed a net $2.7 trillion from global financial markets. And yet, interest rates at the end of the year were the same as where they were at the start.
Yeah.
So that tells you there's a lot of appetite. But there must be some limit to this, and we don't know where that is. But I think we're particularly vulnerable if we're ballooning the deficit, but we also have clear dysfunction in the running of the government. So it's not clear that there's any fiscal discipline being imposed upon the government at all. That is kind of a dangerous scenario, and that could lead to higher rates. I think even without that, I think we're getting a break right now because equity markets are doing so well that portfolio managers all over the world are busy selling equities and buying bonds to try to rebalance portfolios. That's creating tremendous demand for U.S. treasuries. But if we had an equity market correction, people have to rebalance back towards equities, those long rates could shoot higher. So I do think that the amount of debt and deficit we have right now, the trajectory we're on, is limiting the ability of long-term rates to come down.
So an important floor on those long-term rates, even as the Fed cuts rates.
Yep.
But seems like at least there's a ceiling there in terms of there being plenty of demand, external and internal.
There is for the moment. And I wouldn't want to be too alarmist on it. I think part of the story, it's not just the money. It's about how people assess how our political system is working.
Yeah. All those debt ceiling fights, budget shutdown fights, which I assume are ahead of us.
Well, yes, but to be fair, we had, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years, we had some debt ceiling fights. But between the administration and the House and the Senate, they did actually manage to get the job done. We came too close to the brink, but there does seem to be still a majority of members of Congress and in the administration who aren't going to do something crazy like default on the debt. So I think that one I'm not that worried about. And even on government shutdowns, I think that both parties realize that it's probably not a good idea and you don't get any thanks from the general public if you shut down the government. So I think that's a little less of a risk, but who knows in the future.
And it's interesting because I focus a lot on emerging markets, as you know, Latin America. And currently there is another increase in the debt happening down south. And this has such an impact on the risk premium, on long-term yields, on the currencies. But it seems like the U.S. keeps being exceptional, right? And just being that reserve currency.
Well, I think there are a few things that really help us. I mean, one is being the reserve currency is tremendously important. I think also the fact that trade is a relatively small part of our GDP is actually quite important because we only export about 11% of our GDP. We import about 16% of our GDP. But that means we are sort of in economic terms, a closed economy. And that means that if the U.S. dollar were to fall sharply, it doesn't have a huge impact on the economy. Unlike for example, countries in Latin America, where if their currency falls, suddenly they've got huge domestic inflation and they've got unions who will, you know, demand wage increases to compensate them, and so you can get into an inflation spiral. The U.S. is less likely to get into a dollar crisis and an inflation spiral because of a debt issue than would be the case in many other countries. Even in the U.K., when Liz Truss was briefly prime minister, Britain kind of got into a crisis like that. But it's because it's a small open economy, and we're actually not. We're a big, mostly domestic economy, and that actually protects us a little bit from foreign investors getting scared about U.S. debt.
Mm. So moderate a little bit how preoccupied we are about
that. I think that's true. I think that is true, but I think one of the keys here is this all works so long as inflation is low. If inflation starts rising, then you've got more of a problem. And then the other thing is we're really in uncharted territory because, yes, our debt-to-GDP ratio is not as big as it is in Japan, but on the other hand, we don't save as much as Japan. We don't have a low inflation rate like Japan. But also, we have a much bigger demand on global capital markets than Japan does. So we really don't know what each country would probably have its own limit, and we don't know what the U.S. limit is.
Be tax active with J.P. Morgan. Financial professionals can easily track estimated capital gains for over 5,000 funds with our heat map analysis tool. It's a quick, easy way to avoid large capital gains and identify more tax-efficient strategies. Run an analysis now at jpmorgan.com/heatmap.
What can really policies do to help improve that trajectory? Here, thinking about the spending side, are there ways to cut spending? And the revenue side, will eventually we just see higher taxes?
Yeah, I think you can. There are lots of ways of fixing it if you have the political will. Yeah. Because first of all, you don't need to fix it all at one time. If you could just stabilize the debt to GDP ratio wherever it is. And by the way, if you stabilize it, suppose you stabilize the debt to GDP ratio at 100%. If nominal GDP growth is then, say, 4% per year, and you run a deficit of 4% of GDP, oddly enough, the debt-to-GDP ratio will still be 100%. So you're actually allowed to run a deficit of about 4% of GDP. You just can't run 6 or 7 or 8 without it going up. And that's kind of the problem. So you don't have to get down to zero. Getting down to 4 would be good. And I think, you know, what can you do? Yes, I think you do need to see some tax reform. I think that we do have a structural deficit which we need to address. But there are many other things. I mean, you know, one thing that I think we really should address is just overall labor force participation. How can we help the American population stay healthier longer so they can work longer, so they can participate in the labor market and therefore be a source of revenue for the government rather than simply a source of spending, which is going to be an increasingly important problem as our population ages. And then you can use, you know, how can you enhance technology to make us more, increase our productivity? AI is, I think, has got the promise of greater productivity growth, but that can help too. And then, you know, we spend a lot of money on things like defense because we live in a dangerous world. Can we, you know, the whole it's a negative sum game for the world. You know, China spends a lot of money it shouldn't be spending on defense. So does Russia. So do we. So do many countries. We would all be better off if we spent less on defense. That would allow us grow in other areas, but it could also constrain the growth of federal debt. So there are ways of dealing with it in the long run, but it starts with the will to say that there's a problem and we're going to address it.
And so many of those are very tough to fix. You know, half of it is just entitlement spending, right? How do you cut Social Security or Medicare, Medicaid?
I think that's right. Tough. I mean, I don't worry that much about Social Security, which is almost just an income redistribution program from taxpayers to older people. The growth in Medicare is more of an issue, and we do need to, you know, we spend more on health in this country with less of an outcome, you know, positive outcome than almost anybody else. We're not getting good bang for our buck in healthcare. And there are, you know, I think there are things we can do to make the population more healthy, which would actually, you know, curtail healthcare spending, which could be quite important, by the way, would also make people feel better.
In terms of spending, former President Trump has talked a lot about other ways, perhaps, to reduce spending, more government efficiency, for example. And then on the revenue side, he's talked a bit about raising tariffs and raising revenues that way. Would any of this change that calculation?
Well, I've never, and this, my father was in politics years ago, and politicians always talk about one way they're going to fix deficits, get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. That people say that. There's nothing there. The tariffs could raise some revenue. The problem is they will also slow the economy. Because if you put tariffs on, you get revenue in, but it's a tax on consumers, so they will tend to spend less in other places. But it also adds to inflation, which could cause the Federal Reserve to raise rates. Meanwhile, you get retaliation, which will hurt our exports and slow the economy down. So you would actually, potentially, if you did enough, you could end up in close to recession. Now, you're not going to ever, you know, help the deficit in a recession. So I don't really think that's a starter in terms of actually funding things. It's really the wrong way to go. America is a very competitive economy. We're very competitive. Our companies are the best in the world. That's perhaps why they trade at such high premiums in terms of PE ratios. So we really should be embracing global trade because that's where we can, you know, perhaps we should do it with a lower dollar. I think it'd be nice to see the dollar come down a bit. But I don't think the tariffs are the way to go. And certainly there are no fix to the federal debt or federal deficit problem in the long run.
And how should, in this context, how should investors think about positioning in light of this worsening deficit, debt situation, and perhaps down the line, eventually higher taxes?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of two things. One, I wouldn't panic. I think we still have some years in terms of runway here before we have a crisis. And that gives you time to reposition. You know, I think people need to think about diversifying a bit. I mean, one of the, you know, global diversification is not particularly popular, but there are areas of the world where they are more cautious about the debt. I mean, I would argue that the Germans are way too cautious about debt, and boy, do they follow the rules. But they do actually have a better, you know, I certainly would trust the German government always to pay on German bunds, more so than I think that the U.S. Congress could be trusted to always behave in a fiscally responsible way. So there are other countries where you have more fiscally responsible programs, but just in general, just be diversified because, you know, this is just one shock, but there are many other shocks that could hurt the economy or hurt portfolios in the long run. You just don't know where they're coming from. So I just say a lot of people are looking at, they have very concentrated portfolios because the U.S. stock market and mega cap stocks have done particularly well. There's probably too much in that bucket. Mm. And to the extent that you can, in a tax efficient manner, redistribute that to try and reduce the overall level of your portfolio to mega cap U.S. stocks or even to things that would get hurt by a rise in long-term interest rates, you probably should do so. And that means international. It also means alternatives.
And David, you mentioned that word tax-efficient way, because I think regardless of the outcome of the election, the presidential, the makeup of Congress, we shouldn't get complacent that taxes are only on their way down. Eventually, they could be on their way up. And so just finding a way of optimizing investments around taxes.
Well, that's right. What I would say also is that we are probably entering an era of lower returns going forward just because we've had such extraordinary returns in recent years. And, you know, if you're talking about 10% or 11% or 12% returns per year, the tax issue is not a big issue. If you're talking about threes and fours and fives, then avoiding paying taxes on those gains is quite important. So I think people need to be more tax efficient and tax aware. I think, you know, I think it's going to be a while before the political trajectory really leads to a big increase in taxes. I don't think it's going to come out of this election, but it's also something to think about. And I think, you know, anything you can do to increase after-tax returns by reducing tax exposure, of course, is, you know, those returns are just as valuable as any other return.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for joining me today. So much to unpack, and I'm sure we'll be talking about taxes, the deficit, and the debt for all of 2025 and beyond.
Absolutely.
This episode wraps up our mini-series on the U.S. election. For more timely election insights, check out our Election Insights Hub at jpmorgan.com/elections. And to all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and we'll speak to you soon.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.